I must say I'm delighted to be identified again as a rabble. I would take it that all of you are rabbles as well. And I think we need a lot more rabbles engaged in these kinds of struggles to move forward. I was struck by one of Jill's observations about how the system gets so corrupted with the technique of overwhelming potential critics with material of the printed word, like this 140-page healthcare bill. And that brought to mind a struggle that Carolyn and I and Ken Harstein and several other people were involved in Holyoke to try to resist committing Holyoke to a corporate contract for 20 years and $170 million to clean up their wastewater. And the principal instrument was a contract of 700 pages. And it was only because Carolyn went down to the public works office the day that they were going to foreclose public comment, and then she learned that the bill didn't even exist. They hadn't read it yet. And when they finally did, of course, they tried to keep it under wraps, and I will say that, once again, citizen action saved the day. Saved the day is probably too ambitious. It helped to delay the day, in another sense. Through Holyoke Citizens for Open Government became the principal entity for fighting this outrageous contract and this incredible waste of public money in a municipality that's one of the poorest in the state. So I think we have a lot in common, a lot of trouble to make, a lot of dust to kick up, and I wonder if any of you have comments. Yeah.
Sort of a two-parter. First, the right of recall, along with the right of referendum, seems to be an important right. Referendum we've seen used a fair amount over the years. When was the last time we had any public legislators chastened by a recall vote? That, and I'm sorry, I do have a second part that's semi-related. That is, there does seem to be a great coalition of civic groups, at least potentially. When I think of, say, Common Cause, I'm not sure how effective they've been lately. You know, potentially, Common Cause, a Public Citizen, and others could form a great alliance, I should think, and prospects there on those two points.
Interesting. Good thoughts. On recall, I have never seen it used, and, you know, I don't have a clue how it's used, when it's used, or if it's still even around. I don't know if someone else. Yeah. Does anybody have?
California's the only place I've ever heard they recall everybody all the time.
I haven't heard of it, not in my political lifetime here. Interesting thought. On coalitions, it's a really interesting dilemma to struggle with. And with the Mass Coalition for Healthy Communities, you know, that was one of our thoughts early on, that we would, you know, that we would try to work with some of the more influential groups. But what we found was that the large groups have very committed, agendas. Their work life is really full, and it's not flexible. So they don't work with the surprises. They, you know, they have to kind of focus on what their year or their 5-year plan is. And they are not kind of flexible and agile. They also have a lot to lose because they have, you know, they work very hard on their particular bill or two, and they have to protect their working relationships with the legislature. So we found, you know, early on we would try to get large groups to work with us. And then we found that we could be much more effective just working with the little groups because they had nothing to lose. The little groups are completely disempowered to start with, and they're not protecting anything. But there are sure a lot of us, and we are, you know, we are fighting angry, and you know, we have learned that that's really where the action is. It's with the little small groups. And, you know, it's been just so delightful to see how powerful an ally small grassroots groups are. And, in fact, Mass Coalition for Healthy Communities is mostly, it's like people who sign up on the website, and then it's small groups, that little neighborhood associations that may or may not even have a name, but you know they tend to organize to protect a little piece of land that they want to keep. So it's very informal and it's rather fluid, but it seems to be, you know, a model for organizing that seems to be working.
I want to thank you for your very clear and, you know, sort of stimulating analysis of how things work. I want to go back to 158, the healthcare, so-called healthcare bill.
Okay.
And I remember reading a lot about that, you know, I guess in the Globe, and I remember the backroom, you know, deal, though I think the spin on it was, isn't this wonderful how these guys who disagreed came together? And I remember reading about, you know, how little healthcare was going to be bought with that amount of money and $295. So it seemed like a really bad deal. And I remember going to a community meeting in North Adams with a lot of social workers and healthcare workers and so on. And I thought there would be a lot of opposition to it. And I don't know if people were sort of resigned, but at least we're getting something. So I guess my question in terms of rounding out the case study, what happened to, what was it called, Healthcare for All?
Yes.
And
yes.
You said 4 or 5 years ago it almost passed, you know, in a referendum. What happened to that opposition? Because I think we need to know more about that.
Yes.
To understand the
big good picture. Good. Good points, because that's a piece of the story that really is very important. The referendum 5 years ago in 2000, question five, for universal health care was overseen actually by MassCare, a broad coalition of lots of public interest groups. MassCare notably split with Healthcare for All around that referendum. Healthcare for All was bought off with the promise of a voter bill of rights. And that was a very devastating split. And this is common practice for the powers that be, is to try to split the coalition by buying off a piece of it with some little perk. And that happened, but, you know, so that coalition split at the time, but MassCare has continued, you know, with its advocacy for single payer. And MassCare was basically shut out. They were slammed. They were not a part of the healthcare discussion. You know, the really foremost healthcare organizing entity in the state was eliminated in the course of the Chapter 58 discussions. Notably, Healthcare for All was not. And not to cast dispersions on Healthcare for All, but some have learned to call them Healthcare for Some. And I think one of the very interesting things here is the funding dynamics. And nonprofit funding is not available like it used to be. And so the groups that we used to look to for public interest advocacy have been a little bit hamstrung, shall we say, by the sources that they have gone to for money. So you see groups like Healthcare for All, on whose boards are sitting now some of the health insurers. Or you see like CHAPA, the Citizens Housing and Planning Association, supposed to be our foremost affordable housing group, which, you know, has developers on its board. Even Mass Audubon, you know, has developers. MACC, no, not MACC, I take that back. MAPC, the Metropolitan Area Planning Coalition, which is one of these regional planning associations. They are different across the state, but in the Boston area, which is the largest one, they are now headed by a developer. So, you know, this is certainly part of the problem, that the public interest groups have been significantly co-opted by their funding. And again, it's another reason why the rabble has become such an important resource, because it's sort of the one place where you can get people that have not been corrupted. It's like why it's so much harder to corrupt town meeting than a city council. There are just too many of them. You can't buy them all off. Well, same with the grassroots groups. It's sort of like the people's legislature. So Does that pretty much answer your question? Yeah. Great. I think there was a question back there. Yeah.
I was interested by what you were saying about the fact that there are so many uncontested elections. And as you were talking about the changing of the boards, board of directors for Western Nascosh, and we have a heck of a time finding people who are willing to volunteer time. Mm.
Yes.
I'm just wondering if sort of public...
People don't know what Nascosh
is. I don't want to say the Western Nascosh is the Coalition for Safety and Health. Western Mass Coalition for Safety and Health. It's sorry. and it's it's was brought into being by the unions in the Pioneer Valley Labor Council, and is an offshoot from them. But we have a really, really hard time finding people who are willing to serve on the board. And I'm just wondering if that's part of it, is that people just don't want to spend time doing that anymore.
And I think, I think that's not by coincidence either. As the economic climate, you know, has become more and more unforgiving, you know, and people are leaving the state because they can't afford health care and or the housing, and they can't find jobs. The other piece of this is that people don't have time to participate in their civic lives. And, you know, you kind of get into this negative feedback loop where the harder it is to participate in your community, the more the whole process gets co-opted and corrupted, making it all the harder to participate in your community, et cetera. And, you know, down we go. And the question is, how far does it have to get to make, you know, to sort of force that reengagement? And I think we don't know, but clearly the more organized we are, the more ready we will be for the pushback. And I'm not sure, you know, in my own thinking about this, I wonder whether it will take a local Katrina, you know, disaster, or, you know, the oil supply goes down, or, you know, what will it take to kind of mobilize that public...
Shake them up a bit.
Yeah, exactly, and kind of get people out of their routines to get down to the source of the problem instead of dealing with, you know, the keeping the roof over your head, which you have to do. You know, how do you then, and getting your kids to do their homework, and, you know, how do you take care of your family and your needs, and get back to kind of the systemic problems? It's really hard to do that. And what will it take? You know, will it take a disaster, or will it take something wonderful? You know, like that you know, just a resurgence of community spirits. And, you know, I don't know. It could be either.
People to even spend the time to learn about occupational health and safety.
Yes.
Yeah.
Much less do anything in it.
You talked about two areas. One is healthcare, and the other was lack of democracy in our state.
Yes.
And I wanted, I'd like to know about whether you have about, in this whole country, about 13 million people belong to unions, and a whole big percentage of municipal workers. My question is, have any studies ever been made, taking a state with a gross national product of adding up and equating that with the amount of union membership in that state, and talking about the legislation and the health care and how this union membership impacts on the conditions, the life, the quality of life conditions of the people? Because the reason I ask the question is I've heard that this state has a whole lot of people who make high incomes and highly educated people, and also some industrial people, but they have the lowest union membership, one of the lowest in the country. So my question is, how do you see this impacting? And I have another side question, that is that nobody you go to these talks and nobody talks about how the war impacts on people's consciousness, their thinking, the demoralization, and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, let me just say that those are really great points. And I don't know the numbers, but I kind of share the, you know, the the feeling, certainly, that, you know, when you lose union representation, you know, you lose a very powerful force for democracy and economic justice. And I would love to see a study that, you know, that looks at that. And I would love to know how Massachusetts compares to the other 50 states. I wouldn't be surprised. We've got, you know, a lot of service industry, you know, that hasn't been well organized yet. It would certainly make sense that the two go hand in hand, that declining union membership and, you know, just economic hardships really go hand in hand. Maybe when we get to a certain critical threshold, it will start pushing unionization again, hopefully. And about the war, absolutely. You know, what is the war costing us, like $2 billion a week now or something like that? I mean, it's just outrageous. And that money is, you know, it's money that would otherwise be spent here at home, you know, building hospitals and schools. Instead, we're spending it destroying hospitals and schools overseas. 8,000 person. Unbelievable.
I have a two-parter, and they're both dealing with the systemic issues we talked about. The first is, I'm still in total disbelief that the legislature could exempt itself from the open meetings law. That's a little bit like saying that one of the states in the union decided to exempt itself from the Constitution of the United States, because the open meetings law is basically the bedrock of democracy. It is transparency.
Well, can you define that? I wanted to go back. What's the definition of that open meeting law?
Well, okay. An open meetings law is a law that requires notice of a meeting. It requires, and it goes hand in hand with public records law. Municipalities have them. Everybody in the country has them. I never heard of such a thing. An open meetings law says that whenever a body that's publicly elected is going to deliberate, well, I'm answering him. Whenever a body that's publicly elected is going to deliberate about making laws, the meetings have to be open. Discussions
published.
Yes, published.
It's published.
That's right.
When there's a bill that's going to be discussed, it has to be made available in advance. There has to be some public comment. There has to be due process, which means that people have a chance to look at it and get back to their legislatures. Didn't we all have civics about how bills become a law, and that the bill has to be published and people have to read it and have to be public hearings and people have to weigh in? I mean, for a legislature of a state to say, we're exempt from all that. That's sort of like, you know, like the Soviet Union. Now,
yeah.
So maybe that's, I'll just ask that question. Hasn't the Civil Liberties Union ever thought about taking the state to the, you know?
Well, I know that the, there's a, the Publishers Association, the Newspaper Publishers Association for the state, is promoting a reform bill for the open meeting law. Unfortunately, it doesn't address that loophole. It just tries to put some traction around the municipal open meeting law, which could also use a little more traction too. You know, but they are the only advocacy group I know of that's actually working on it. And I find that very few people even know that that's the case. Massachusetts was one of the first states to draft an open meeting law, actually, in 1955. We were ahead of the game in 1955. And the law was revised in the early 80s. And I'm not sure where the exemption came up, whether it was there all along or whether it was put in the 80s. I don't have a clue. But, you know, it's amazing. And the literature on it, if you Google and you're trying to find out about the open meeting law in Massachusetts and you're doing a web search, you will come to the Attorney General's website, and you'll read his little 10-pager about the open meeting law, and you'll think, okay, I know everything about the open meeting law. Well, turns out that little document describes the open meeting law at the municipal level, and it doesn't tell you that it doesn't apply at the legislature. And in fact, it states that this is a three-part law. It applies at the state, county, and municipal level. And so you read it for the municipal level and you assume that it's analogous for the other, but you know, you have to talk to someone who knows. You have to dig up the bill itself. You have to go to Mass General Laws and find the bill, and I don't have it offhand, but I probably have it in the car if you want it.
Didn't we have a forum out here with Phase 2 and we should demand that every single member of the legislature who represents all the cities and towns in the Pioneer Valley come to a public hearing and we confront them and ask them, why are they keeping their mouths shut and weren't they all going up there and having a riot and demanding this open meetings law? We can't do public hearings.
Well said. Well said.
Accepted themselves secretly, or did they justify it publicly why they were accepting themselves? Which was the case?
Good question, you know, and I haven't been able to find anything about that. It, you know, it was in 82 or it was in 55. You know, I don't know.
One member of the legislature? Anyway, my second parter was a really segue into allowing you to talk about your campaign.
Yeah.
Because we've all read, Greg Palast, everybody is talking about the stealing of our votes. And just within the last week, there was a dynamite op-ed piece in the Gazette where someone said, are we all dreaming? We're talking about these elections, and we all know that they're being stolen, and everyone's talking about is 2008 going to be stolen. And why are we going into these elections next week thinking, or the week after next, thinking, you know, they're not going to be stolen? And then what happens? The Boston Globe has a front-page story that Galvin is buying Diebold machines for the state. And we all know that Diebold machines are rigged, and the Diebold is one of the big Bush supporters. So it's a corporate question. It's legitimate for this evening, but I think it's an issue of special concern to you for, on several levels. So please speak about it.
Great, great. It's not clear what is happening because the secretary is moving with his characteristic secrecy on this. And so we're not exactly sure. And in fact, I don't think it's been covered by the Globe yet. You know, the Globe. In the Globe? Well, it's not been in the Globe Well, it was actually in, get this, in the Massachusetts Town Clerk's Monthly Newsletter is where it was. Maybe it's in the Gazette because the Globe has not touched it with a 9-foot pole yet. Yeah.
About what kind of machines are being bought?
Well, the fact, I mean, this is an announcement. It's just mentioned in passing in the Town Clerk's Newsletter that Diebold TSX, which is the most diabolical Diebold, and what's called a ballot marker, which is a fairly innocent, it's not a voting, you know, it's not a touchscreen machine. It simply uses electronics to mark the ballot for people who are physically disabled or blind. So that seems to be a fairly innocent piece of technology. All this is part of meeting the requirements of the HAVA Act, the Help America Vote Act, which is, yes, that's right. And one of the things that HAVA does is, you know, bring in this technology for the disability community. And what's very unfortunate here is that the disability community has been really toyed with. You know, they're sort of being jerked around and told that their needs are going to be met and these electronics are going to meet those needs. And now they're hearing that there are dangers in those electronics, and they've been kind of just shut out of the loop in this whole discussion. So it's complicated, but suffice it to say, it doesn't serve anybody's needs to have them vote on a machine that is insecure and liable to tampering and malfunction and all that. We don't know how many Diebolds are coming in. We don't know how many of the other devices coming. We don't know numbers. Even the town clerks don't know. And it's particularly the poll workers, you know, who are very much up in arms about this because they're going to be left holding the bag. And here they are. They are overwhelmed to start with. Now they've got to learn this new, very unfriendly technology at the 11th hour. So, I mean, it's just nuts that this is happening. It boggles the mind. Why in the world is he doing this now at this late date? And why in the world is he bringing in Diebold TSX when other states are in the process of banning the technology? Why are we bringing it in? It's crazy. It's crazy.
It's sickening.
Florida.
Can
yeah.
we call him?
When are these machines, according to the information that you have, when are these machines to be put into effect, and what are the communities? If
we don't know yet which one. I've heard informally that it may be 26 communities around the state. And they will be used this November in this election.
Do communities have any discretion to say no?
Right now, the machines, I should add, right now the proposal is to bring them in simply in the testing mode. There are real votes that will take place, but we have not bought them. They're apparently just being rented now. Although this is all secondhand information because the secretary is not publishing this anywhere, but fairly reliable sources have said that they're being rented. This is part of testing the machines prior to certifying them in order to meet the HAVA requirements. So this is not water under the bridge, but it is really important for us to make sure that it doesn't become water under the bridge. And people do not have to vote on them. Nobody has to vote on them. And that's one kind of option I think that we should seriously think about, is getting the word out and alerting people that, you know, why risk your vote and why give a vote of confidence in these machines? You know, we should be telling the Secretary of State, you know, this is nuts. This is an offense to the voters. It's an offense to the disabled community. We should not be going here, especially not at the 11th hour. You almost wonder if this is calculated to kind of catch us off guard and do this very quickly so that they can just kind of usher them in. It would not be surprising. Yeah.
I'm a member of Amherst Town Meeting, and just this summer when there was a budget appropriations, there was a little line there that said $80,000 for electronic voting machines. And this is one of those things where you just kind of like run right through it and you just vote on the whole thing as a package, because there was money for, like, you know, repairing such and such municipal building. And about five hands went up, including mine, you know, with questions about this when like they were going through, like, does anybody have questions about line item A, B, C? Mm-hmm. And then D or whatever it was, you know, it was the voting machines, and, you know, a bunch of people raised their hands. And, you know, it was like a federal grant, you know, that was required that it be used then for these voting machines. You know, and you know, I made a comment. I said, you know, check out Black Voting or Black Box Voting or whatever.com. You know, they are exposing how there's really a fundamental rot happening right now in the very institutions of liberal democracy. Even the most basic rights that we thought we were afforded under this system are being rotting away with these very machines. And, you know, people said, you know, you don't have to worry about that because, you know, it's a democratically, solidly democratically controlled state. And, you know, obviously they wouldn't want Diebold to be running the voting machines when they're so clearly, you know, giving money to the Republicans and even thanking Republican operatives and state government for, you know, thank you for the election. You know? Or no, I think it was the other way. Somebody, there was some famous quote of some, probably someone else here knows it better than I do, some Republican thanking Diebold for the election or something like that.
And it was the CEO of Diebold that promised to deliver the election for George Bush.
Jill's got it. Yeah, there you go. I mean, but I think it brings up a broader
Did they bias?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, I was the only one who voted no when it came to like approving or disapproving the entire budget. You know, I don't know if we had legally the right to refuse this, but it brings up a broader question to me, which is that it seems that when you have a situation where the most basic institutions of liberal democracy, of constraints on state power are rotting away, and, you know, these are the kinds of things that we, like, came to learn about in civics class, you know, this is, like, what our society is supposed to provide. I think that the very roots of that rot are in representative democracy itself, in the idea that you can represent your power, that you can have somebody make decisions for you, that you vote for individuals who have power to act rather than being a conscious actor in your own community as part of a collective process determining matters of public life. I think that we're in a dilemma here because on the one hand, it's very important to fight against this kind of neoconservative rotting liberal democracy, but I don't think that we stand on firm ground when we try to like put up essentially, for lack of a better word, liberal principles as the way against it. Like, we need institutional counterbalances. I mean, like things like town meeting, you can assert power in a way through that institution in a way that like we can't when we're, you know, just putting out fires all the time whenever something like this is happening. I mean, it sounds like your organization has been incredibly effective in like mobilizing very quickly to stop certain things, but I mean, it's like we don't have the institutional grounding to really challenge the kinds of rotting and perversions that are going on.
Right, which is why it's not enough. It's not enough to simply stop bad bills, you know, and that kind of power is not going to do it for us. And, you know, it's only a first step. It's damage control, but it has to get to something that's more creative, you know, and something that's more democratic and more engaged. And, you know, I think it's a longer, you know, kind of a longer discussion, but, you know, sort of surgically striking at the worst parts of the structure, you know, like the lack of an open meeting law and, you know, the secrecy of the process, the money, you know, the power of money. When you begin to do that, then you sort of begin to unleash the power of civic engagement. And I don't know if anybody saw now David Brancaccio's Now on Friday night, and anybody watch that. But it was so beautiful to see what the political process was like under the clean election system in Arizona. That was mostly what they profiled, and a little bit in Maine too. It was so neat because you began to see just these little community meetings happening all over the place, and people feeling like you know their future was theirs, it belonged to them. And once you begin to feel empowered, then you start to get, you know, some traction, and it feels like the system belongs to you. So it seems like we don't have to get there in one giant leap, you know, but if we can start making some inroads, then we can begin to build just a whole different vision of who we are and where we're going.
Do you think it would be a effective strategy to call the Secretary of State?
There are a lot of people who try to do that, and his policy is usually not to call you back. All sorts of people that you would think he would call back, he would, and I have not sort of, you know, being a his adversary in this election, I have not tried that one, but I think I'm the least likely person that he's going to talk to right now. In fact, the other night, Emily Rooney, who's like the host for Greater Boston, you know, the PBS sort of local political analysis show, he was on her program maybe 3 weeks ago, and she asked him if he was going to debate. And he said, yes, of course, I'll debate if a reputable organization asks me. So she asked him, and no, he would not debate. Emily Rooney was not good enough on PBS. That's not good enough. So, you know, he's not interested in talking with me, put it that way. Did you have a question? Yeah.
I wish we could have the money to have TV ads so the whole country kind of gets to realize what's going on.
Yeah.
We need a lot of money.
Or we need public airtime, you know, which is the other piece of the solution here, that these are public airwaves and there is a contract, you know, which the FCC doesn't enforce. But there is a contract that there's supposed to be some reciprocity here. And it should be, I think, available not only at election time, but all the time. There, you know, there should be much more news programming. And there is some very good news programming out there. But it, you know, it requires an institutional commitment, which there isn't, because it's mostly big profit-driven corporations that are, you know, so it's all mixed together. But in the same way that the problems converge, so do the solutions. And if we start, that one is a tougher solution because it's at the federal level, and it's very hard to move good things at the federal level. It's much easier to move good things closer to home, where you can get this kind of sense of community engagement and you can build some momentum for it. Much easier to watchdog things and have transparency. So I'm not... the media stuff is really important, but it feels like it's going to be – it's not the first or second or third thing that we're going to get to. But there are other things that we could do easily.
I was just thinking of the voting machines.
If
people would know that it's not a good idea.
Well, fortunately, there's a big pushback happening on the voting machines in many of the states now. You know, it's just right here where Galvin is trying to slip them in, but he may have a very hard time doing that.
I want to say that, having spent much of my adult life backing lost causes, I was reminded from our discussion a moment ago about the class characteristic of the problem that's facing us. Most of us don't. It's difficult enough to get Americans to recognize that there are social classes, since we're all middle class, everybody knows that, let alone that some people are in lower classes and some people are in higher classes. And there are a very small number in the very top that essentially run the game. And the cause that engaged me a good many years ago was to try to come to grips with this by creating something we call Democracy Day, recognizing that low-income people are usually overwhelmed just trying to get bread on the table. Many of them work two jobs. They don't have time. Literally, time was the point that Catherine made. They don't have time to engage in these kinds of activities. And along with the no less intractable question of how we deal with this awful disparity in income in our society, which is getting worse as we speak, and yet how do you create a more equal society? I mean, that's one of the great conundrums for all time. But we need to recognize that the ability to participate actively in the political process is a function of social class, and that's a tough one.
Yeah.
What can we do to help you win?
Yeah, there you go.
You read my thoughts. Let me just say that this is one of those kind of like strategic, I think, opportunities, because Galvin has been there for 12 years. He's not well-liked. He's not out there talking to the communities that he serves. He's really kind of the bureaucrat's bureaucrat, and he's the insider's insider. Very much a part of the machine. When Clean Elections was sabotaged, he was silent. You know, he who oversees elections and lobbying, he basically oversees not only democracy, the important critical institutions of democracy, but also the institutions of influence peddling. And when Clean Elections was ambushed, he had absolutely nothing to say about it. You know, it was ambushed in the worst of ways in the back rooms. He had nothing to say. Fair Districts recently, he did nothing for that. In fact, after Clean Elections was killed, he actually proposed that we raise the contribution limits so that people can give $1,000 a pop, not just $500. And he spends most of his time sort of pursuing investment cases, you know, investment fraud, as opposed to doing anything about elections or money in politics or lobbying or influence peddling or protecting the right to vote. He's more interested in protecting investors. So he's not done a lot to endear himself to the broader public, but he has, you know, all the support of the machine. I think one of the reasons they're not discussing this race is because it's so eminently winnable. It's a two-way race. There's no Republican in it. And, you know, people are hungry for change. 57% of people now in the polls are saying that Beacon Hill is seriously on the wrong track. So, you know, it's potentially a winnable race. And, you know, all the usual stuff applies. You know, if you are interested in making phone calls, we are phone banking. And Joyce over here has lists. We're actually calling top-notch independent women voters. They're easier to persuade than registered Democrats. They're independent. They're women. Women's voices are going to be in very short supply on Beacon Hill. And they're very interested. You know, these are people who vote all the time. So they're interested to hear about, you know, a very interesting and potentially winnable race. So we're getting actually a really good reception. People like doing phone calls. That's great. If you, you know, if you want to put up a yard sign, we are out of them at the moment, but we're supposed to have them tomorrow. Oh, you have three. Okay. And we'll, Joyce will be resupplied soon.
I'll be happy to help transport signs whenever they come in.
Great. Thank you so much. Pat, do you want to say a word about what else people can do? This is Pat Keeney. If people don't know Pat, who's my campaign manager.
The phone calls are critical just because right now the media has subjected us to a blackout. We've had conversations with various reporters that make it clear that we're not going to have the coverage that we need to get a message out broadly, and we probably won't be able to afford much more than some print ads in regional weekly papers. So phone calls are very important. But each person here is very likely an opinion leader. I know I worked with a number of you on John Bonifaz's campaign. Mm-hmm. Probably you're involved in a governor's race, whether it's Deval Patrick's or Grace Ross's, and you have contacts with people in your community. And every person that hears about Jill Stein between now and November 7th, from someone like you, someone whose opinion they may value because you spend time coming to meetings like this and educate yourselves, don't take that for granted. You probably carry weight with your friends and your family and I would say go through your Rolodex and send a message out to your whole email list saying, you know, I met Jill Stein or I spoke to Jill Stein and she's worth our consideration on November 7th for the reasons, whatever reasons you choose. Talk to Joyce and get a list of unenrolled women voters and, try to get 10 or 20 of them to vote for Jill. We're at 13% right now. But that's with a lot of undecideds. Galvin's right around 50%. Anything could happen. And the higher our total is on November 7th, the more momentum we have going into the next part of the struggle, which, as everybody has talked about here, has to go on. I mean, just even if Jill were to win that one office, we'd still have a huge fight on our hands. So, get involved if you can and be ready to fight after November 7th because we'll all be in this together still.
And we have an email sign up list over there. And if you do, or you can go to our website. Pat, do you have flyers? I don't know if we can pass flyers out here or outside. We can do it on the way out. But if you take a flyer, you can take the website, which the website is just my name, jillstein.org, too, and you can sign up on the newsletter. And I think, the name of the game here is building not only for November 7th, but for the long haul. And, if you're interested in the campaign, we'll help you roll over, to the long-term collaborating, both with Shays 2 and then, with MCHC and so on. So, the same stuff lives on. But I think this race, really is exciting because the secretary does oversee the basics of democracy and influence peddling and public information. The secretary is actually the chief public information officer. So it gives the secretary the prerogative to direct public attention to wherever the secretary thinks it's important. So, Bill Galvin is directing attention to, Medicare pharmaceutical packages. we can think of a few other things it boggles the mind how really, what a powerful force for change the office can be. And it's not so hard to get people really excited about it. Exactly. That's right. We want to be the anti-Catherine Harris. That could happen. And most people have not looked at the race. They haven't thought about it. It's like giving out candy to tell people that this office could actually be working for us instead of against us. And it's winnable. It's a two-way. So it's great. I mean, it's great to tell your friends about it and get them excited and see if they want to help you make phone calls and make them together. And, it could be a really exciting prospect. And either give us your email or sign up on the web before you're done.
just want to say, if you enjoyed this evening, please get on our Shays to list and help us do more of this kind of stuff, and also join us in some of our plans to get an open meeting law in this state.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Carolyn. And thank you, Ward.
I want to make one other comment about the duties of the Secretary of State that Bill didn't mention. Secretaries of State are also responsible for chartering corporations. So I can tell you, Jill, that the day after you get elected, I'm going to be knocking on your door so we rewrite the corporation code in Massachusetts.
Terrific. All right. You're coming in with me. I'm not going into that office without you.